Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Oncology. This podcast aims to bring you expert perspectives on the pathophysiology of cold agglutinin disease, the steps needed for an accurate diagnosis, and how emerging treatment options are changing the management of patients with primary CAD. The discussion is guided by pre-canvassed questions provided by the hematological clinical community. Financial support for this medical educational activity has been provided to Touch IME by an educational grant from Sanofi. This activity is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME.
Hello, my name is Professor Maury Gertz, and I'm professor of the Art of Medicine and Chair Emeritus Department of Medicine at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this discussion of understanding the immunopathogenesis of cold agglutinin disease. What are the implications of new and emerging therapies? I'm here with Professor Bernd Gilma of the Medical University of Vienna and Dr. Shirley Desah of University College London Hospital in the United Kingdom. Today, we'll be discussing understanding the immunopathogenesis of cold agglutinin disease, navigating the evolving treatment landscape in cold agglutinin disease, and individualizing of cold agglutinin disease management in the clinic. We'll start with understanding the immunopathogenesis of cold agglutinin disease. Cold agglutinin disease is a subset of autoimmune hemolytic anemia, and it includes a number of distinct forms. The most common is warm antibody-mediated autoimmune hemolytic anemia, which can be idiopathic or primary or be secondary to autoimmune disorders or medications. But 15% of autoimmune hemolytic anemia is cold agglutinin type. There are a couple types: primary cold agglutinin disease, which would be the type associated with a monoclonal IgM protein fixing complement to the red cell surface, and secondary, which can be associated with acute infection, underlying autoimmunity. And third, there's paroxysmal cold hemoglobinuria, where activation of complement to C9 results in red cell lysis. It's not pure, however, because many patients will have a mixture of both cold and warm antibody-mediated hemolytic anemia. Cold agglutinin disease is traditionally defined as autoimmune hemolytic anemia mediated by cold agglutinins, and patients may have evidence of a clonal B-cell lymphoproliferative disorder without frank evidence of malignancy. Cold agglutinins represent autoantibodies that react optimally at 4 degrees centigrade, but can react at higher temperatures depending on the thermal amplitude of the antibody itself. The pathophysiology of cold agglutinin disease goes to a monoclonal B cell, usually lymphoplasmacytic cell, capable of producing IgM cold agglutinins, usually monoclonal, occasionally polyclonal. And these IgM are capable of binding to the red cells. And when they bind to the red cell, they can cause the in vitro agglutination that we see on the peripheral blood smear, but they also activate and fix complement to the red cell surface. And ultimately, C3 fixes to the red cell surface. And after convertase, C3b is adherent to the red cell. And there are specialized receptors in the body, in the mononuclear phagocytic system, that recognizes it and will lead to hemolytic destruction of the red cell. Formation of a complex in severe disease can result occasionally in intravascular hemolysis, but the bulk represents extravascular hemolysis. So these patients have the laboratory signs of hemolysis, but don't generally have dark urine, flank pain, fever. I'd like to move to a panel discussion with Professor Gilma and Dr. Desah. And we want to review a number of questions for discussion. Dr. Desah, how do you diagnose cold agglutinin disease, and what tests do you find useful in the clinic?
Thank you, Professor Gertz. The first important test is to perform a direct antiglobulin test to identify what components are present and whether there is autoimmune hemolysis. If this is positive, strongly positive for C3D, then that is indicative of cold hemolysis. There may also be some positivity for IgG, and the strength of the positivity of both these components does give an idea as to whether you have primarily cold, warm, or mixed hemolytic anemia. Other tests that are important are to confirm the presence of hemolysis include bilirubin levels, haptoglobin, and also, of course, hemoglobin will tell you what the end result is of the hemolysis. And reticulocytosis helps us to understand whether there is compensation of the hemolytic process.
Thank you very much, Professor Gilma. What do the guidelines say about the diagnostic pathway? There are multiple published consensus guidelines. Can you review how you use them?
There is a diagnostic algorithm. First, as Dr. Dizar pointed out, you start with a sort of common laboratory parameters, looking in whether hemolysis is ongoing or not. And then if you identify the hemolysis, you're looking for the autoimmune process by the DAT, the direct antiglobulin test. And eventually you progress if you see the typical pattern, which is, for example, positivity for C3D, and no or minimal IgG in the direct antiglobulin test, you would perform a titer of the cold agglutinin titers. And once this titer is confirmed to be equal or greater to 64, you would end up with diagnosis of cold agglutinin disease, although, of course, there could be a mixed form if you still have an antibody like an IgG.
Thank you, Professor Byrne. Dr. Dessau, when you see an anemic patient in clinic that you suspect hemolysis, what is the differential diagnosis that includes cold agglutinin disease?
Well, there are a number of autoimmune and infective triggers that get the immune system going. Complement is a ubiquitous part of our immune systems, a very traditional, if you like, a long-standing component. So it can be triggered by a variety of mechanisms. So I would seek out evidence of autoimmune phenomena, such as SLE, rheumatoid arthritis, and similar. I would also be very interested to know if there are active infective symptoms in the patient. There are some infections well known to trigger hemolysis, such as mycoplasma. But at the end of the day, I would also be looking for a monoclonal component to identify the primary form. But certainly looking for secondary and ruling out those causes is very important, because if you treat those underlying causes, the cold hemolysis can actually be abrogated.
Thank you very much. Professor Gilma, in the clinic, what are the markers that you actually use in the evaluation of patients in informing your diagnosis and assessment of a potential cold agglutinin disease patient?
Yeah, of course, as is stated, the haptoglobin is invariably non-measurable if this is active disease. The lactate dehydrogenase is an enzyme which may be a little bit elevated, but not necessarily. The direct antiglobulin test is something you need for the confirmation of the diagnosis. And the cold agglutinin titer is once again a parameter which you need for the confirmation of the diagnosis. If you have a low titer of cold agglutinin disease, like 1 to 8 or 1 to 12, 16, then diagnosis that of cold agglutinin disease is unlikely. In addition to that, we find the bilirubin quite useful as a marker of the ongoing extravascular hemolysis. If the bilirubin is normal and you still have severe anemia, There may be other reasons for the severe anemia, which could be, for example, a bone marrow infiltration with a low-grade malignant non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And also in Dr. Dizar's practice, she, of course, sees many patients with a paraprotein. And if you have high IgM titers, you may want to look into the bone marrow to diagnose lymphoplasmacytic lymphoma, because there are specific treatments for that. So you're then looking at secondary forms of cold agglutinin syndrome.
Thank you very much. So summarizing, cold agglutinin disease is a hemolytic process, extravascular, with the typical markers of hemolysis, indirect hyperbilirubinemia, absent haptoglobin, elevated LDH. The direct antibody test, the Coombs test, is invariably positive, but instead of being positive for IgG, it's positive for complement. And you can see at 4 degrees centigrade the ability of the IgM protein to agglutinate these red cells, leading to a firm diagnosis. We'll be discussing navigating the evolving treatment landscape in cold agglutinin disease. Here is an evolving treatment algorithm for cold agglutinin disease that has been published in Blood Reviews. When we see a patient with cold agglutinin-mediated hemolysis, the differential diagnosis first is primary cold agglutinin disease, where there is no underlying cause, and then secondary cold agglutinin syndrome, where it's usually a transient effect due to infection, where supportive care, and if there's an identified underlying disorder, such as an autoimmune disorder or an infection, that's treated. All patients with cold agglutinin disease don't require therapy. There are those that are asymptomatic for whom monitoring of a mild chronic anemia is certainly acceptable. And of course, if a clinical trial is available for these patients, then enrollment is strongly encouraged. Patients with minimal symptoms can simply receive supportive care. Therapy becomes optional. Prior to the introduction of anti-complement therapies, however, symptomatic anemia, transfusion dependency, and patients with severe symptomatic circulatory symptoms, such as acrocyanosis, Raynaud's phenomenon, did require therapy. For patients that needed surgical intervention, elective or non-elective, with the presence of a cold agglutinin that requires extracorporeal circulation, emergency plasma exchange can be used to remove the monoclonal IgM protein from the serum. Other treatments that have been evolved include eculizumab, as its ability to blockade C5 can have some impact on the hemolysis. Previous publications indicate that treatments directed against the monoclonal lymphoplasmacytic B cells, such as rituximab or rituximab with bendamustine, as treatment for the low-grade lymphoproliferative process, can be effective. Other treatments that have been successfully reported in the treatment of cold agglutinin disease include rituximab with fludarabine or bortezomib monotherapy. There have been a number of publications on investigational therapies for cold agglutinin disease, which include ibrutinib directed against the plasma cell, as well as venetoclax. But there are two important novel agents, one approved, one currently under active investigation, as complement blocking antibodies that don't have an impact on the production of the IgM monoclonal protein. One is sutimlimab, which is a monoclonal antibody targeting C1 and is approved for use in the United States following 3 published trials. The second agent, which is a C3 inhibitor, is pegcetacoplan, which also has been published in a phase 2 and currently accruing in a phase 3 trial that have been successfully used in the management of cold agglutinin disease. Once again, we have a set of questions that we're going to be discussing with Professor Bernd Gilma and Dr. Shirley Desai. Professor Gilma, how can treatments such as rituximab, sutimlimab, and plasmapheresis be used in our current treatment algorithm?
Yeah, first of all, I think you have on the one hand the plasmapheresis, which we will probably use only for the very acute cases to stop hemolytic crisis, which will lead to a reduction of the circulating IgM antibodies. You will achieve something similar if the subject or the patient is responding to rituximab, but this response will take some time, which is usually somewhere in between 1 and 3 months. In between that, you have now the option of the first authorized product for this particular indication, which is sutimlimab, as upstream inhibitor of the complement system, which is able to stop hemolysis if it's driven by cold agglutinin disease within a couple of hours. And this may completely obviate the need for plasmapheresis. And you can use this as a bridging therapy to rituximab, or you can use it as a chronic treatment to carry on if the patient is responding. And response rates are typically in the 80% range.
Thank you. Dr. Desai, how do you in the clinic sequence therapies as this disease evolves and patients are exposed to other therapies?
I mean, that is a very important question, Professor Gertz. Most of the time, patients present, the first question is, do they need treatment? Sometimes a particular trigger may settle down and they may be stable. But in general, most people would consider, I certainly would, introduction of single agent rituximab. I might consider, after waiting an adequate time, I might then consider chemoimmunotherapy, adding an agent such as bendamustine, because the depth of response is better. But that does have to be balanced against the toxicities. So as time goes on, I think using the disease burden is a good guide. So what is in the bone marrow? Do they have any bulk disease that can be targeted? But that's, I think as the disease evolves, it doesn't always act in parallel. So you may do some disease reduction, but there may still be active hemolysis. And sometimes these processes seem to divert and or just separate and do their own thing. And I think that is where, you know, the use of a complement inhibitors can come into their own. One of the problems, however, is that it's not a widely available treatment as yet, complement inhibitors. They are available, although FDA approved. They can't be freely prescribed, sutimlimab, for example. But in an ideal world, I would love to be able to use a complement inhibitor in an acute situation when someone is actively hemolyzing and at risk, a very severe clinical risk, in someone who is prior to surgery, which is a really potent trigger of hemolysis. And also in people who are not responding adequately to rituximab and or chemoimmunotherapy. I mean, there's a whole algorithm that can be explored, and I think we're in the thick of testing how best to use these agents.
Thank you. Professor Gilmer, we're all in a resource-constrained environment. How do you factor in therapy cost when you make decisions on intervention?
Yeah, costs are very important, of course, but they may also be country-specific. With the given pressure on our health system, you may want to consider starting with the therapies Dr. Desai has pointed out, like single-agent rituximab therapy, and see whether you can control the hemolysis. If you need an emergent treatment, the cost shouldn't be an issue because neither plasmapheresis nor complement inhibitors are cheap. So you would like to start probably with a complement inhibitor right away.
Dr. Desai, are there any specific treatments you would consider inappropriate, contraindicated, likely to be ineffective when you're facing a patient with cold agglutinin disease?
Well, I think frequently clinicians, when they encounter autoimmune hemolytic anemia, even if it is cold, they will often turn to steroids. And I think in an acute situation, it's an understandable approach because you want to control things. However, I think if there is primarily a cold phenomenon happening, I think they should be withdrawn as soon as possible, because there is really a very limited benefit from steroids. And they, of course, can contribute a lot to toxicity, bone health, immunosuppression. So I think steroids should be severely limited in this group of patients. And of course, as we move to more to therapies such as, if we include bendamustine or fludarabine, which show in published publications that things can be effective, we need to be very cognizant of the immunosuppressive effects in the long term and use these agents with caution, particularly now in the post-COVID era, where immunosuppression and antibody suppression is of particular importance. And finally, one word on plasma exchange. I think it can be very difficult in these patients because you have to warm the system, and that is just something to be aware of.
Thank you very much. In summarizing this module, there really are two approaches to the management of cold agglutinin disease. One would be directed at the clonal B cells responsible for producing the cold agglutinin production. But a second new option would be complement inhibition, which doesn't deal with the production of the antibody, but actually prevents complement deposition on the red cell, leading to extravascular hemolysis. Now we'll talk about individualizing cold agglutinin disease management in the clinic. There are unmet treatment needs in cold agglutinin disease based on prior experience with conventional therapy and its impact. In a retrospective analysis of cold agglutinin disease outcomes in 232 patients, there were 24% that had not received prior treatment, 45% that were treated with rituximab monotherapy, and 59% who responded more than once to therapy. Deeper responses have been reported with rituximab fludarabine and rituximab bendamustine compared with rituximab alone. There is a higher risk of late occurring malignancies with these chemotherapy-based treatments, as well as a continued increased risk of thromboembolic events. The disease burden and the symptom burden on these patients is significant. A retrospective observational cohort study with 60 months of follow-up demonstrated that 34% of patients were hospitalized in the first year, 53% of patients hospitalized over the entire follow-up period. And despite therapy, patients still experience moderate to severe anemia and hemolysis up to 5 years after diagnosis and beyond. The STRIDE trial was an overview electronic analysis of medical records of cold agglutinin disease from a very large database. 45% had anemia that was severe, another 34% had moderate anemia, and 79% of patients were anemic at the time of diagnosis. During the follow-up period, there were 7 severe anemia events per patient year. Severity of anemia fluctuates for every patient over time. It's a relapsing, remitting disease. But many patients remain severely anemic despite multiple interventions. And that's the unmet need, is that therapy is inconsistently effective. And this decline in anemia is clearly associated with a substantial impairment in overall quality of life. In addition to the anemia, however, these patients have a much higher incidence of venous and arterial thromboembolism, as well as cerebral thromboembolism. And when you look at a long-term follow-up of patients with cold agglutinin disease, there's a 1.9-fold overall increased risk of having a thromboembolus in patients with chronic sustained cold autoimmune hemolysis. We're now going to ask Professor Bernd Jilma and Dr. Shirley Desai to answer some specific audience questions with us. Dr. Desai, what indications or biomarkers can we use to select patients eligible for immunotherapy?
So by immunotherapy, I'm taking you are referring to rituximab type of therapy. I think, as we've mentioned, the presence of active hemolysis that's impacting on the patient who has a clonal burden of disease, even if it's small, could well respond to that kind of approach. However, there are other forms of immunotargeting that we can now do in the form of complement inhibitors. And that is a very attractive option, in my view, for these patients. I've seen for myself through the trials how patients benefit. In terms of specific biomarkers, I think that's still work to be done. But if we're using the standard approach to managing this disease, active hemolysis, where there's a considerable impact on the patient, particularly if they have not responded to agents such as rituximab or remain impeded by this disease, would benefit, in my view, very much from agents that target the complement system. And avoidance of therapies that are ineffective and over-treatment with treatments such as rituximab or chemotherapy is also very important. Otherwise, patients just get the pain without the gain.
What's your experience with the use of intravenous immunoglobulin in these patients?
We have had to turn to that in some patients because they have been getting recurrent infections. And of course, recurrent infections triggers hemolysis. So it's a real double-edged sword. We have used this in some. It's primarily guided very much by IgG levels. We have a very strict threshold for prescription of IVIG due to the global shortage. And it can be beneficial, but you have to keep the trough high. And it's a very much individualized case-by-case situation. But I have found that in the complement setting, the use of vaccination against encapsulated bacteria has been extremely effective. I think when we embarked on these therapies, we were concerned about the risk to patients, but that has not been borne out by experience. So that is another important thing. And I often recommend this approach even in patients who are not going ahead on a complement trial. I think it's good background protection to offer these patients.
Thank you. Professor Jilma, how can we better manage the symptoms associated with cold agglutinin disease, particularly the circulatory, the Raynaud's, acrocyanosis, livedo reticularis, vascular issues? How do you approach that?
Yeah, this is, as Dr. Dissart pointed out, a difficult issue because even with the complement blockade, you will still see those symptoms because these are not addressed by the complement inhibition, but are probably caused by the agglutination of the IgM antibody. So you would have to direct your therapy against the underlying IgM production, and which is probably a cytoreduction in terms of you could try first a single agent rituximab therapy. You could look into the bone marrow if you find evidence of Waldenström's disease, if you find evidence of MyD88, and this patient would then be a candidate for ibrutinib therapy. Otherwise, one could consider the more aggressive immunochemotherapies like bendamustine plus rituximab. But as Dr. Dissart pointed out, this is not without pitfalls, and you have to observe the patients closely because of the long-term immunosuppressive action of this treatment, and the elderly and frail patients may not be fit enough for that.
Thank you. I was wondering if each of you could share with me your real-world experience managing these patients and how symptomatic they are. Dr. Dissart, would you start?
Yes, sure. What I find is that there are recurring themes with these patients. Many of them are quite weary from having a chronic disease that is often difficult to even manage with every clinic visit because the blood testing requires special handling. There is a high rate of failure, especially where hospitals are not that familiar with the fact that blood needs to be kept warm. And so there is quite a lot of fatigue about the handling of blood tests and the need to repeat. Physically, they are often very fatigued in a chronic way. They can't determine whether this is due to their busy lives or whether it's due to age in some patients or whether it's due to this disease and how to differentiate the contributions to fatigue. And I think they often find it difficult to communicate this with family members because on the outside, they may look completely fine. And then the other thing is they feel that it's a very it's something that is unpredictable. You know, sometimes they're fine, other times they suddenly get much worse. There is often a weather climatic kind of contribution, but not always. And in some patients, there is seems to be a steady worsening of their condition overall, even after they may have had therapy, which was previously successful. So it's a real, I do find a kind of a mixed bag of individual experiences, but recurrent themes that come up for patients. And I think fatigue is very, very central to that. And I think also the impact on their quality of life is also very notable, and it needs more attention.
Professor Gilman, would you share with us your clinic experience with these patients?
Yeah, without repeating what Dr. Dessau has already pointed out, I think the fatigue, the chronic inflammation which is accompanying this disease, this can be felt, and the difference if they are treated well, for example, if they respond to a complement inhibitor, is very easily and quickly seen by the patient. So one of our patients reported that while she was on complement therapy, for the first time since several years, she didn't feel like dying soon. So she could feel this difference.
Thank you very much. So in summary, we're dealing with an uncommon form of hemolytic anemia, and the differential diagnosis must be kept in mind if you're to arrive at an accurate diagnosis and avoid the use of corticosteroids, which is our standard for warm hemolytic anemia, but are likely ineffective in cold hemolytic anemia. And recognize that we have two strategies available for the management of the disorder. One would be a B-cell directed therapy designed to reduce levels of cold agglutinin, and then a relatively recently introduced therapy of blocking complement so that the red cells themselves would no longer be complement coated and therefore impervious to destruction outside of the circulation. My thanks to Dr. Dessau and Professor Gilma. We want to thank you for taking the time to watch this discussion about understanding the immunopathogenesis of cold agglutinin disease and the implications for new and emerging therapies. We certainly hope it has been useful for you.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this and related topics on Touch Oncology at www.touchoncology.com. Do keep checking back for any updates as we launch further activities in cold agglutinin disease.